Today in Studio 360, the poems that exactly 100 years ago shocked readers by suggesting that small-town America wasn't so picture-perfect.
Sick. Sick. Thinking of my failure. Looking into the abysm.
Life in Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River Anthology wasn't pretty, but it was real.
Edgar Lee Masters hit the heart of a disillusionment that was abroad in the land.
And the young singer-songwriter Mackenzie Scott, who performs under the name Torres, turns her Southern Baptist upbringing into some of the most thoughtful rock and roll around.
I'm just trying to take this new skin for a spin.
Torres plays live here in our studio.
Pray for me, would you?
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360. But to start the show, gala dinners raise money for good causes, but they aren't usually exciting or even very interesting. Still, when the Pen American Center, the literary/human rights organization to which I belong, asked me earlier this year to serve as an author host for a table at their dinner this year, I was happy to say yes. I expected it to be the usual thing, worthy and ho-hum. But then, a couple of weeks ago, six of my fellow authors suddenly announced they wouldn't be hosting tables. They'd be boycotting this week's dinner because they disapproved of one of the honorees, Charlie Hebdo and its murdered cartoonists. Then another couple of hundred of Penn's 4,000 American members said they disapproved too. And then lots of other well-known writers criticized those critics, and the American literary media world had divided into arguing factions. At the center of all this are Charlie Hebdo's satirical depictions of Muhammad and Islam over the years, the very thing that had gotten some of them murdered. The American critics decided that because Muslims faced so much discrimination in France, Charlie Hebdo's satire had been at least unworthy of the Pen honor, if not racist and Islamophobic. Defenders say that A, that racism charge just isn't true, and B, the courage of Charlie Hebdo's writers and cartoonists to do what they did, despite threats and attacks before and after the January 7th attack that killed 12 people in Paris, is exactly what this Pen Award is for. Gerard Biard, the new editor of Charlie Hebdo, was at the Pen Gala to accept the award, where he said that, quote, being a citizen is to learn that some ideas, some words, some images can be shocking. Being shocked is part of democratic debate. Being shot is not. And he joins me now. Gerard, welcome to Studio 360, and welcome to New York for the first time.
Yes, thank you. I must say I'm happy to be there, and it was very moving for me.
Were you surprised that Charlie Hebdo getting this award provoked this controversy here?
No surprise, not at all, because we used to have these controversies.
Right.
You know, in France, we love controversies. And Charlie Hebdo is always and have always been in the middle of controversies. So, no. But the only thing I would like to say to these authors that they missed a wonderful evening.
They did indeed. Now, to those of them, and some of these six said exactly this, that Charlie Hebdo has been racist, what is your denial, refutation, defense of that?
Well, the first proof of the contrary was the two people who introduced Charlie Hebdo last night. The first was Alain Mabankou, an African well-known writer, and the second one was Dominique Sopo, who is the director of SOS Racisme.
Which is the big French anti-racism organization.
Yes, yes. And I must add that historically, Charlie Hebdo has always been an anti-racist magazine. We fight against all discriminations to women, to gay people, to Muslims.
Since the January 7th, has the nature of what you do at Charlie Hebdo been affected by the killings, or have you just tried to go about your business?
It would be a lie to tell that we won't be affected, you know, because we became a symbol, and we're not meant to be a symbol. We're just reporters, cartoonists. We just want to do our job, and our job is make people laugh and think, and that's it. So maybe now people must grab for themselves these values, these ideas that they want us to symbolize.
Right.
And they belong to everyone.
When an event happens, like I think of the other week when this French schoolgirl who was Muslim, who was wearing a long skirt, was thrown out of school. When an event like that happens, do you and your fellow writers and editors think, okay, this is about Islam, we got to think more carefully about how to respond to this, how to depict this?
We always think about when we publish or a cartoon or when we write something. We are really not irresponsible, you know. When we published for the first time the Mohammed cartoons, the Danish cartoons, we published them because the day before another newspaper, another French newspaper called François, published them, and his editor-in-chief was fired for that. So we decide to publish them, but not publish them like that. Publish them with comments, thinking about what they mean, what they represent.
Right. Now, you have a security person today with you. Are you, every day when you're traveling around Paris, are you fearful for your safety?
I can't only speak for myself, but it's because it's different for each people in Charlie Hebdo. But no, because maybe because I wasn't here when it happened. I was in London, I was in vacation, and I didn't saw the bodies and the blood of my friends. So the feeling I still have is not fear, is anger. So no, I'm not afraid, but I must say that I know that there is some danger, of course. These people are not kidding. They are not making jokes, not at all.
Well, Gerard, it has been a pleasure meeting you, talking to you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And have a good trip back to Paris.
Thank you very much.
I can't believe that this is the only time you've been in New York. I just find that impossible to believe.
Yeah, well, it was a marvelous time. Thank
Great.
You.
Gerard Biard is the editor of Charlie Hebdo. A couple of weeks ago, Sean Ramesvaram, host of our sibling podcast, Sideshow, came on to talk about hip-hop. And he made a major claim that 2015 would be hip-hop's best year yet. Sometimes I got game, sometimes I'm mad shy. Sometimes I'm mad lame, sometimes I'm mad fly. Sometimes he played a bunch of tracks, including Kendrick Lamar and Heems, to make his case. But not every one of our listeners totally agreed. One of them, who calls himself King of Men, thinks hip-hop in 2015 no way, no how compares to what was coming out in the 1990s. Hey, 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 lady. He writes, Heems and Kendrick are great, but Kanye, Drake, yawn. 1988, 89, 92, and 94 are all pretty hard to top. 2015 doesn't even come close so far, but it's cute that Canadian dude thinks so. It's okay. Sean can take it. He knows he's Canadian. And by the way, if you're going to be in New York City later this month, you can tell Sean what you think in person. He'll be at WNYC's Green Space fulfilling a dream, getting NPR's Lakshmi Singh to wear a hat that says,
I'm Lakshmi Singh.
It's an actual hat that Sean made as sort of a joke. He got a ton of public radio people to wear it, and now, finally, Lakshmi herself will put it on. At the event, there will also be a spelling bee, a conversation about what we mean when we talk about diversity. Also, a pinata. You can find out all the details at studio360.org/sideshow. Coming up, Dylan Landis was a successful journalist, but she didn't think she had a novel in her until she took a fiction class taught by the author of A Wrinkle in Time.
She would give us an assignment, and she would say, you may write for 30 minutes and no more. You must set a timer, and you must stop when it goes off. I couldn't stop. I would stay up until, you know, 2 or 3 and then write and write and write.
Those late nights paid off because now Dylan Landis has published a terrific first novel, Rainy Royal. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Once you're an adult, you can look back on adolescence with bemusement, maybe even fondness. But at the time, being a teenager, weird, bewildering, operatic, lonely, thrilling, scary, I could go on. I've read very few books that depict that time as rivetingly and disturbingly as the new novel Rainy Royal. It's New York City in the 1970s. Rainy lives with her jazz musician father, no mother, in a house crawling with dad's hangers-on. She has to navigate the indignities of high school, untrustworthy friends, and the sexual advances of adults. Rainy Royal is the first novel by Dylan Landis, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to Studio 360.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Good. You were a design writer before you started writing fiction. You published, I discovered, a successful, charming-looking series of books, including one about bedrooms, which struck me because no place is as important to a teenage girl, having fathered two of them, than her bedroom and making it just as she wants and being able to be alone there and have it be this three-dimensional expression of who she is. So tell me about Rainy's room.
Rainy's room is porous. It does not fully belong to her. Her father's girlfriend has painted it pink. In fact, her bed canopy is pink, her sheets are pink, her rug is fuchsia, her walls are pink. She wanted to paint it black. And it's porous because her father's best friend, Gordy, slips in and out at night and makes these night visits. He doesn't go so far that Rainy can go running to her father and say, this is outrageous. She doesn't really know if she has a right to complain at all.
And it's the 70s where those rules were as blurry as perhaps they've ever been.
I don't think there were rules at all.
Yeah. The scenes in which Rainey's father's friend touches her and has sex with her are uncomfortable to read, obviously. But they are also incredibly skillful writing because it's uncomfortable, because Rainy is trying to understand if she likes these advances or not, if she likes the power her sexuality gives her, how she's supposed to use it. Was that your intent, to unfold the ambivalence?
The ambivalence was about the power. It was never about the touch. The touch makes her, it freaks her out.
Right.
And she goes into the state that she calls faking sleep. It's as close as she can get to putting herself in a coma. She does not want this man's hands anywhere on her hair or on her back. But the power that she has to bring him to this level does fascinate her. And she does have this effect on boys and on men.
Yes.
She radiates sexuality.
And tries on women.
And she does use it on women.
And depicting that complicated sense of her own sexual power, given that she is this recurring victim of assault, given our culture right now, must have felt a little dangerous for you to do that.
No, it felt cathartic to do it. The 70s themselves felt like a dangerous time to grow up, and we had no language to express any of this besides the word gross.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as a registry for sexual offenders. The word statutory rape was just a joke.
Yeah.
The idea of a 14 or 15-year-old girl going out with a guy in his mid-20s.
Happened all the time.
Or older 20s. Exactly.
Even teachers.
Even teachers,
yeah.
Absolutely. Certainly bosses for after-school jobs. There was no language for this.
Yeah.
We know today where the blame falls.
Yeah.
We didn't then.
Rainy, the character, started off as a secondary character in a collection of short stories you wrote, mostly about another girl, a sweet, bookish girl named Leah, whom Rainey bullies in that book. What made you decide then, some years later, to do a whole book about Rainey?
Well, I needed a bully for Leah. Uh-huh. That's how Rainey started.
Yeah.
And then I needed a reason for the bully to be a bully. And that's how the story on Rainey came about in that first book.
So she got too interesting.
She got way too interesting for her own good.
Yeah.
And she needed a book of her own.
Yeah. Rainey has her own best friend slash bully, a girl named Tina, who is glamorous and dangerous. At one point, they're playing this game where they walk the city streets talking about who they might rob. But it turns out the fantasy includes the fact that they have brought along an actual gun.
"We're just practicing," says Tina. "We're just playing," says Rainey. "We're just taking a walk." "Yeah, but we're walking behind them," says Rainey. She and Tina have turned right about 20 feet behind a couple who lean into each other, slowly strolling. And here is something Rainey has noticed. Couples don't attend to their surroundings the way solo walkers do. She wonders if the gun in her purse has a magnetic pull, if it wants to be near people. "We're losing them," says Tina. They're playing robber girls. Before they took the gun out for a walk, Rainey and Tina were up in Rainey's room wrapping tie-dye scarves around their heads to disguise their hair. They put on cheap lime green earrings from 14th Street to take attention off their features and t-shirts from Gordy's room across the hall to hide their own tops. The earrings and t-shirts will go into the trash afterward. That's the idea. Would go. They're just playing. The man and the woman amble on through the purpling evening, past the trees that encroach on the sidewalk. "Gordy didn't mind you going through his stuff, huh?" Rainey regards Tina as they walk. She wonders if the question is loaded. Tina is the only person on Earth who knows about Gordy's night visits. But they are best friends. Plus, Rainey doesn't want to be one of what her father calls those eggshell people.
An idea that keeps coming back again and again in various ways in this book is power. Rainey getting a sense of power, sexual and otherwise, and figuring out the boundaries and uses of that, which struck me as, kind of adolescence in a nutshell.
I think it's like that for certain girls, not for all and maybe not for most. But I think that there's a subset of girls who, in the 70s for sure, were the cool girls or the mean girls.
Yeah.
And those are separate groups. Sometimes they overlap and often they don't.
They usually overlap a little.
They can.
Yeah.
But in my high school, there were many cool girls who were not mean at all. But you couldn't get near them.
Yeah.
You knew how many centimeters you had to stay away from them.
Were you a cool girl or a mean girl?
Neither.
Ah.
I was a wild girl.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't be cool. I didn't have it in me to be mean, but I could be wild.
Yeah.
And I could take that wildness and I could go back to another subset of girls who were quiet and I could impress, I thought, the hell out of them.
Yeah.
And I recently made contact with one of the cool girls. And I said to her, "You guys radiated this kind of light. Was I imagining this?" I wasn't imagining this, right? And she said, "No, I felt powerful."
Wow. And Tina, you're the mother of a boy who's no longer a teenager. I mean, boys can be mean, but are they just not as determinedly cruel as teenage girls?
I didn't notice much cruelty after grade school.
Yeah.
And even then it was teasing. I wouldn't call it bullying.
Yeah.
Our son, the way he played with other boys, they would lug their computers over to each other's houses and set up the computers and have these parties where they didn't actually speak to each other.
Yes,
they
isn't that weird?
Computer games.
Yes. Like me, you were a nonfiction writer for a couple of decades before you became a fiction writer. Were you one of those journalists who are always thinking privately, someday I'm going to write a novel. Someday. I think I can write a novel.
Surprisingly, no. It was not a dream that I had. In eighth grade, I briefly entertained the thought. I thought I might write a novel about running away to California.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
That doesn't count. That lasted for about 10 pages in a spiral-bound notebook.
Yep.
No, I thought that if you wanted to write, you had to be born with that gift the way Joni Mitchell was born with her voice. So I never tried. And I just stayed with journalism very happily. And a friend insisted when I was about 40 that I take a workshop with Madeleine L'Engle, who had written a book called A Wrinkle in Time.
Oh, yes. Madeleine L'Engle, yes.
That Madeleine L'Engle. And I had grown up on that book.
Yeah, of course.
And I took this workshop, and she would give us exercises every week, writing exercises as homework. And these writing exercises just pried me open like a can opener.
What did she teach you?
Madeleine did not so much teach us about writing as set up a situation in which we had to write. She would give us an assignment, and she would say, you may write for 30 minutes and no more. You must set a timer, and you must stop when it goes off. Because if you know you have to stop, you'll write. I couldn't stop. I would stay up until, 2 or 3 in the morning and write and write and write.
You said before we went on the air that you were revising some stuff today. So you're in the middle of working on a new piece?
I am working on a new novel with many of the same themes.
And Rainy?
I hate to jinx myself and talk too much about
maybe,
future work. But yes, maybe.
Good, because I'd like to see her again as a, say, adult. I was a full-on adult.
I'm not sure I know how to write about other people.
Dylan Landis, it was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Sure. Dylan Landis's novel Rainy Royal comes out in paperback this month. A century ago, in 1915, Spoon River Anthology was published. In more than 200 poems, the residents of Edgar Lee Masters' fictional Midwestern town of Spoon River speak to us from the grave. And death has made them talkative. They tell us about their unrealized hopes and dreams and damaged lives. The book was a landmark in American poetry. The poems took on taboo subjects, sex and abortion and suicide. And they told a story of everyday America that was not positive or pretty. And it became a bestseller. Curtis Fox looked into Spoon River Anthology on its centennial and its legacy.
Spoon River Anthology sold 80,000 copies in its first year and has never been out of print. I'll say that again because for poetry, that's pretty much unheard of. Since 1915, Spoon River has never been out of print. Edgar Lee Masters was already a ripe 46 years old when the book came out, and his previous efforts gave absolutely no indication that he was someone who would radically change American literature.
Masters anticipated modernism.
Douglas Unger is a novelist who teaches at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and at the Black Mountain Institute.
And I think what he did, consciously or not, is that he took on and critiqued the whole trope of bucolic rural America with the white farmhouse and the red barn and the brimming silo.
Harold Arnett.
Take this poem and its portrait of a man trapped by his life in rural America. Harold Arnett says he's a failure. We don't know why, he doesn't explain, but failure in those days usually meant bankruptcy. He speaks to us about his last moments.
I leaned against the mantel. Sick. Sick. Thinking of my failure. Looking into the abysm. Weak from the noonday heat. A church bell sounded mournfully far away. I heard the cry of a baby and the coughing of John Yarnell, bedridden, feverish, dying. Then the violent voice of my wife. Watch out, the potatoes are burning. I smelled them. Then there was irresistible disgust. I pulled the trigger. Blackness. Light. Unspeakable regret. Fumbling for the world again. Too late. Thus I came here, with lungs for breathing. One cannot breathe here with lungs, though one must breathe. Of what use is it to rid oneself of the world, when no soul may ever escape the eternal destiny of life?
So here we have a graphic poem about a suicide, where as soon as he pulls the trigger, he regrets it.
Fumbling for the world again. Too late.
which makes you wonder, why did poems like this catch the popular imagination in 1915?
Edgar Lee Masters hit the heart of a disillusionment that was abroad in the land.
Well, I was sort of looking for that in poetry, I guess.
Probably a lot like readers in 1915, Matt Rasmussen was drawn to the brute honesty of Spoon River when he came upon it in his high school library. Matt's a poet now, and his latest book was a finalist for a National Book Award.
In my own life, my brother committed suicide when I was 16, and so I found in poetry a form of mourning that I didn't really see anywhere else. That was private, also in a way public, you know, it's sitting there in the library. And so those are the sort of the poems I gravitated towards, the darker ones. I think there's a few suicides in the book.
And murders and ghastly accidents and sexual violence.
He is, in many of the poems, questioning directly Victorian American values of the way women should behave, the way men and women should behave with each other, what marriage means, what family means. And formally what he did was he wrote a cycle of poems in which more is happening in the white space between the poems than actually happens in the poems.
Minerva Jones.
A sequence of poems that begins with Minerva Jones is a good example of how Masters uses that white space between the poems to tell a complex story.
It's obviously a very, very sad poem.
Minerva Jones is the village poetess. She is sensitive. She is intelligent.
Herbert Russell is the author of the only full-length biography yet written about Edgar Lee Masters.
We're dealing with a person who is herself not particularly pretty. She's also vulnerable because she is very much by herself.
I am Minerva, the village poetess, hooted at, jeered at by the yahoos of the street for my heavy body, cock eye, and rolling walk, and all the more when Butch Weldy captured me after a brutal hunt. He left me to my fate with Dr. Myers, and I sank into death, growing numb from the feet up, like one stepping deeper and deeper into a stream of ice. Will someone go to the village newspaper and gather into a book the verses I wrote? I thirsted so for love. I hungered so for life.
For all its candor, Spoon River is a masterpiece of euphemism. This poem is about rape and abortion, but those words never appear.
It's part of Minerva's character.
That's Kathleen Rooney, a poet, publisher, and educator in Chicago.
She might not put it that way. You know, I think it's obviously a monologue like these pieces are, and I think, you know, he was trying to write it as she might have chosen to represent that experience.
First of all, it's 1915, and one doesn't write or speak directly of such incidents. If anything, you do it indirectly.
She's raped by Butch Weldy.
Captured me after a brutal hunt is in a way more terrifying than, you know, had he just said, raped me.
And she is eventually the subject of an abortion.
She dies from it. I think the image that she presents in the poem is incredible.
He left me to my fate with Dr. Myers, and I sank into death, growing numb from the feet up, like one stepping deeper and deeper into a stream of ice.
Like one stepping deeper and deeper into a stream of ice. It's sort of morbid image, right? But beautiful in a way.
We hear later on about the man who impregnated Minerva Jones. We hear more about the doctors in Spoon River.
Dr. Myers.
Dr. Myers is a victim of the village, which is ironic because he himself has done a lot to save the village and its people.
No other man, unless it was Doc Hill, did more for people in this town than I. In all the weak, the halt, the improvident, and those who could not pay flocked to me. I was good-hearted, easy Dr. Myers. I was healthy, happy, and comfortable fortune, blessed with a congenial mate, my children raised, all wedded, doing well in the world. And then one night, Minerva, the poetess, came to me in her trouble, crying. I tried to help her out. She died. They indicted me. The newspapers disgraced me. My wife perished of a broken heart. And pneumonia finished me.
and pneumonia finished me. this is Masters' view of the village right here.
I think it's amazing that in just a few lines, Masters is able to show how multiple lives were ruined by this incident. And then, you know, you also get Mrs. Myers.
He protested all his life long. The newspapers lied about him villainously, that he was not at fault for Minerva's fall, but only tried to help her. Poor soul, so sunk in sin, he could not see that even trying to help her, as he called it, he had broken the law, human and divine. Passers-by, an ancient admonition to you, if your ways would be ways of pleasantness, and all your pathways peace, love God and keep his commandments.
Mrs. Myers belongs to a group of the very religious that always got under Master's skin. She is very much a village moralist, and what she has learned about morality and religion is apparently more important to her than her relation with her husband.
So now you've got the full story of Dr. Myers' tragedy and Minerva's tragedy and Mrs. Myers. Between them, the reader then imagines the story and begins to put together the story of the interrelationship of the whole town. So the book is visionary in that way. There's no other cycle of poetry in the American tradition that did that.
There are at least two things about the creation of Spoon River that are kind of mind-blowing. The first is that nearly all the characters in the book were modeled on real people, many from the two Illinois towns where Masters grew up. The second is that Masters really didn't know what he was doing when he began writing it. He started it in mocking response to William Reedy, the editor of the St. Louis magazine Reedy's Mirror, which had been publishing his earlier, more conventional verse.
Reedy was a very good critic much of the time, and he was the one who told Masters that you really have to get away from this genteel, derivative, 19th century Moon June and Spoon stuff and give us real life. And Masters felt insulted after one of Reedy's exchanges with him, and so he sat down and he wrote 8 of the Spoon River Anthology epitaphs, initially just as a joke. They were a literary chip on the shoulder, and he sent these to Reedy and said, "Here, is this realistic enough for you?" And Reedy recognized their value, and Spoon River Anthology was underway.
The book turned out to be hugely influential in American culture. Sherwood Anderson read it in one night before writing his classic collection of interlocking stories, Winesburg, Ohio.
Not only Sherwood Anderson, but Sinclair Lewis in Main Street and Babbitt. And later on, certainly Thornton Wilder and Our Town.
Some scholars also point out the tonal echoes of Spoon River's anguished souls in the work of confessionalist poets like Robert Lowell.
I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell, as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell.
After Spoon River, Masters wrote nearly 50 more books, but he reverted to the Moon, June, and Spoon stuff, and no one really reads those books anymore. He died in 1950. The headline in the New York Times made it clear why anyone other than his family and friends would care. Edgar Lee Masters dies at 81, wrote Spoon River Anthology. For Studio 360, I'm Curtis Fox.
Curtis Fox hosts the podcast Poetry Off the Shelf for the Poetry Foundation. Music in our story was by the Claudia Quintet. Special thanks to Pike Malinowski and Katie Peterson. Still ahead this hour, Mackenzie Scott writes some of the sharpest, smartest rock I've heard in a long time. But while she was growing up, her musical influences were not exactly highfalutin.
Let's not forget, I'm a Britney Spears fan.
Okay.
And Backstreet Boys and all of that. I grew up listening to 90s pop and boy bands and loved all of it.
And you have no guilt about that?
Why? Why would I? They're incredible.
Torres writes and plays pretty much the opposite of 90s pop. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Oh, January, keep a secret for me.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. If you believe the hype that's cascading through the music blogs, there is no more promising singer-songwriter than 24-year-old Mackenzie Scott, who performs as Torres. On her new record, Sprinter, Scott transmutes her southern past and the existential confusions of her present, and the result is a lot more rocking than what you'd expect from your typical super-sensitive singer-songwriter. And Mackenzie Scott joins me now with her band to talk and play. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having us.
So you're Mackenzie Scott, this white girl from the middle of Georgia. Why
the one and only.
Why Torres?
Torres is my mother's maiden name. It was my grandfather's name. He was Henry Alvarez Torres.
Uh-huh.
Taking on the Torres name from the maternal side of my family gave me an opportunity to be Mackenzie Scott and Torres. It allowed me to carry on both sides of the family name.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk some more, but will you play a song?
Absolutely.
And this will be the title track?
Yes, this
Sprinter.
Is Sprinter.
Great.
Found myself some ground to stand.
That is Torres performing Sprinter, which is the title track off her new album. So that song, like a lot of the songs on this new album, refers to your Southern Baptist upbringing. There's a line, the Baptist in me chose to run. Are you still religious, or is that all in the past?
I'm not a Baptist anymore, but I'm a Christ follower.
Really? So we won't get into the Protestant specifics of what that means, but...
I don't go to church, no.
Yeah. And I assume your parents still go to the church you were raised in and...
They are in church, yeah.
And how do they feel about these songs?
I couldn't tell you, but I've got a pretty good guess.
Yeah. Not necessarily crazy about them.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They're very supportive.
Are they supportive of your career?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
They are.
Was there, as a kid... And you're young now, but as a 10-year-old or 14-year-old, was there a moment when you thought, I actually have a talent for making music and I want to do this?
I don't think that happened when I was that young. I started playing the guitar when I was about 16.
Right.
So
your parents gave you a guitar.
They
right?
did, yeah. They gave me a guitar. And that was when I started writing songs and singing. It wasn't so much that I, you know, sat there and thought, ah, I've got a talent. No, not at all.
But you sang in the church choir. Were you better than the other members of the church choir?
Absolutely not. No. I grew up thinking I could not sing.
Really?
I didn't even think that I could sing until I was, you know, 16 or 17.
And is it possible, as I've read, that it wasn't until you got to college in 2009, 2010, that you sort of discovered rock and roll?
That's correct, yeah.
How is that possible? There's no rock in Macon, Georgia in the aughts?
Apparently I missed it.
So what were you listening to? Not rock and roll, but what?
At that point, it was musical theater. The Phantom of the Opera was... I think I listened to the Phantom of the Opera exclusively for about 2 years. The film soundtrack.
Yeah. How about things like Britney Spears? Couldn't you have been a Britney Spears fan?
Oh, I was.
Oh.
I was. I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not forget, I'm a Britney Spears fan.
Okay.
And Backstreet Boys and all of that. I grew up listening to 90s pop and boy bands and loved all of it.
And you have no guilt about that?
Why? Why would I? They're incredible. Those are some of the best melodies ever written.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's meant to make people love it.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to college in Nashville. You put out your first record there a couple of years ago. You've, in the last year or so, moved to Brooklyn, New York, along with every other musician on earth.
Oh, God.
And, why'd you come here?
Well, I came to the state of New York because I always wanted to live in New York City, but I'm in Brooklyn because I can't afford Manhattan yet.
Oh, you got to lose that. That's the wrong idea. But you always had a dream of being in New York?
I did for at least the last decade, yeah. My parents brought me to visit when I was 14, and I pretty much had it in my head after that I was going to live here.
It happens.
Yeah.
And has it worked out? Did it fulfill your teenage dream?
It's everything I wanted. It really is. I love New York. It never stops. I like that there's always something to do, and I like all the noise.
Yeah. And not to obsess over your religion, but when you say you're a Christ believer, that's not a thing that people that I run into in Brooklyn say often.
No.
Does it make you feel like an outsider or not fully a New Yorker?
Oh, I mean, I absolutely feel like, I mean, I can make a home anywhere. I don't need people to
reinforce what you're saying.
No, absolutely not. That is a very internalized personal thing for me. So no, I mean,
yeah,
it's not something that comes up in conversation unless people want to talk about it.
You wrote a song on your first record about being adopted. There's a song on this record about being adopted. That's a thing you're working through musically. What is that like to write about something so essential to who you are?
I am working through that, not just musically, but in my life.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's something that I didn't really think about much as a child. I didn't have a lot of questions at all, and now I do, but it's It's something that I still don't necessarily feel comfortable talking about with loved ones in my life, so it's making its way into the songwriting.
That's interesting, though, that you're not comfortable talking to the loved ones in your life, but you can put songs on records about it.
That's how I feel about everything. It's really backwards, but it makes sense for me.
Yeah. Mackenzie Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Will you play us out with another song?
Yes, absolutely.
And this is?
This is The Harshest Light.
Excellent.
Get in line, take your time. It's a lot to decide. Tell me how much truth would you like to buy? Chew and swallow.
That's Mackenzie Scott as Torres performing The Harshest Light with Cameron Kapoor on guitar, Aaron Manning on keys and bass, and Dominic Cipolla on drums. Torres' new album, Sprinter, is out right now, and you can hear all three songs they played for us and see a great video of their performance at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's edition of the show. Thank you very much for listening. Our Studio 360 production team includes
Ital Malad,
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasha Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hook.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, over the centuries, one animal has been called the embodiment of Christ, a symbol of fascism, and a cuddly couch buddy.
I'm just going to let him go, see what he does.
How hawks torture and tantalize the human imagination.
That was amazing.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.